Wyatt, episode 800 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Still Edmund from Washington Heights. I'm amazed we actually made it this far, even if not with everybody on board at all times.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and would now be a good time to renegotiate my contract?
Sure.
I would like I would like a 100% raise in my current pay schedule.
Done.
Jeez, that was easy. Oh gosh. I've been nervous since 780 to ask. Okay.
Okay. 800 episodes. Yeah. Like I said, Edmund, we've definitely had some interesting changes over that time, and definitely a few challenges along the way. Had some hosts come and go, as we definitely have to admit at this point, 800 episodes in, that Bronstum definitely has moved on to other projects.
Yes, indeed.
Let's put it that way.
Well, married life will do that to you.
Yeah, it will do that to you, and some of the other things that kind of come with that package. Yeah. So, the changes that we've had over the years, but and definitely recently we've been trying to make some changes, and I hope that everybody has been enjoying that. It does seem to me like there are some people who are liking the fact that we get into some topics that aren't just episodic discussion, that we kind of get into things that are a little bit deeper topics, ongoing discussions that we revisit. These are all things that just keep us also very engaged as far as this is concerned, just to have a different kind of talk. Because after several years of discussing shows and seasons after seasons, sometimes things get just a wee bit repetitive.
Yes.
Well, and it's not only that, too, but now that, you know, as we've been witness to, there is no dead season anymore. There's no 2-month gap. It just rolls and rolls and rolls. And it was hard to keep up with the hundreds of shows that we were trying to keep up with. So, you know, our decision to, you know, scale back a little bit and give a little bit more focus to ones that matter to us more, I think was a good choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely makes it easier for some returning friends to come back and jump in with both feet. Edmund, 800 episodes.
Yes, and but certainly I do appreciate this that you know, not feeling that we have to cover everything as it became more and more obvious that that no, I mean, this, people talk about this being you know, peak TV, and we have certainly seen that as this show has gone along, you know, going from small roster of shows to really having to be more selective, because there is just too much out there to keep up with, just so certainly been interesting to see as we've been doing this.
Oh yeah, I mean, that could be a topic all of itself, right? Just the fact that we have seen such an explosion of content over the last couple of years, and the way that things have changed, and in fact, not on the roll, but I guess we'll just not a bad place to start, is the rumors, at least, or the possibility of yet another writer strike. And what's interesting there is that it actually pertains very much to what you were just saying, Edmund, is that we see this large expansion of content out there, not just genre content, but overall. And Gary, like you said, there is no such thing as the regular season anymore. It's a continuous loop that we're in. And that has changed the game for a lot of people. We see lots more series with much fewer episodes. You know, when we started even this particular podcast, the norm was the conventional network season of 22 to 25 episodes, depending. And you still see some shows that get the 25 episodes, like on the CW, they like to add in episodes if they can. And we were just starting to see the cable networks do these 13 episode runs. And that was unusual when we started, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the norm. Even on the networks, they tend to do anywhere from 6 to 13 episodes. And from what I understand of reading a little bit into it, this is causing a problem for the writers right now. Because their entire structure of how they did things, and they made themselves available, and that they negotiated time in their contracts and so forth, was built around the old cycle. And now the studios and the networks are taking huge advantage over that. It doesn't affect the actors quite as much because the actors were always used to having to kind of jump from one thing or another if they weren't getting a full contract or whatever it may be. But for the writers, you know, they jump into a project. They say, okay, I'm going to work for this particular show or be in the writer room for this. They would expect to have X number of months of steady work. It's now half that.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to be around and off the market for a good amount of time. So the need to turn around, if you're doing shorter assignments, you need to get out of the assignment into a new one to make up for that half that you didn't get. But there's a lag time now. And financially, that's a hit that they take. So that's just an interesting way that this is affecting people that maybe wasn't obvious before. And we talk about peak TV. Well, what happens then when the writers decide to go on strike again? Right in the middle of peak TV.
Yeah.
John, I think part of what you're saying, though, is you just said it's TV. Now, you know, you have network, you have cable, you have web, or I'm not even sure. What do you call somebody like, you know, Netflix with their original programming? It's not network. It's not cable. Are they affected? Are all outlets affected under this writer's strike, or is it literally network and cable television?
It depends on the scope. I believe that's also still under discussion. But what seems to be a kind of side effect, and this is actually where I first heard about it, is that streaming services like Hulu or Netflix or even Amazon are all poised to actually take advantage of this because the scope is only here in the U.S. They have access to international material,
mm-hmm.
and they can very easily spool that out. Plus, they've got their own independent things that they can do, and they don't have to base it in the U.S.
Right.
They can produce a whole lot of material completely outside of that loop. So they could actually use this to their advantage. And what there is a little bit of talk is that some of the people who traditionally would be on the side of the writers in this are opposing them almost as if to try to force the situation. So it's very much a chess game between all these different sides, because it's like, we can take advantage of these people trying to do better for themselves. In the long run, it'll work for us. So, yeah, definitely interesting. I definitely see the point of Netflix, where they can basically say a certain percentage of our stuff is things already that are rather already aired. Why do we need new stuff? We can handle it. Can you guys? ABC, can you handle it? And considering the fact that there are still people who cite the last writer's strike as really a bad thing for in their memory, bring up Heroes. What's the first thing that people talk about? The writer's strike.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one example within the genre, and there are a ton of them. I mean, there you go back and you look at some of these shows like Supernatural. Yeah, third season, much shorter than it should have been. Kind of had a rough time for obvious reasons because of the writer's strike and so on. So there's a lot of trepidation about that, but I would be really interested to see that when now we have so many cable shows, so many network shows, and they're running around the year and everything else, if you hit a long, extended, protracted strike, like, for instance, the voice actor strike that, from my understanding, is still going. Yeah, this could get interesting. Suddenly that list of like 30 shows per week that we were trying to cover, things might get more manageable.
Indeed, but if it does happen, I'll be quite interested to see what the unintended consequences are this time around, because that last big writer's strike, aside from just the effects it had on certain shows we were watching, also of course it's often cited as one of the things that led to the explosion in reality TV and the stuff that was described as unscripted entertainment, even though we now know exactly how produced and written and manipulated those shows are. But it will be interesting to see if perhaps this time around it does wind up shifting the balance of power away from some of the traditional networks and broadcast networks and cable networks, and provides the opening for these new upstarts like Amazon and Netflix and the other streaming and web services, if they can in fact take advantage of it and fill whatever void is left on the regular networks.
it's just a good opportunity for people to catch up on all the shows that they can't keep up with during the year.
Yes.
And all the other stuff that we don't watch that we want to watch. But anyway, yeah, I kind of just wanted to start there because of the comment that was made. It reminded me that that is kind of looming in the background. But hey, we also had some movies that we've all enjoyed recently and to some degree or another. And Edmund, I was curious about your thoughts on those. And the first one, yes, that I wanted to kind of throw out there, I don't know if there's more on than what's on this list that you wanted to discuss, but yeah, Logan. I recently rewatched that film, and I know, Gary, you saw it and enjoyed it, yes, as well. But Edmund, your thoughts on Logan?
I really liked it. The whole idea of sort of showing a kind of almost this future of sort of post mutant seemed almost post superheroes, letting Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman show off their acting chops a bit more and show what it's like to be on the downside of your life and career and how you deal with that. Made for some very, very interesting different nuances and focuses than you get in the more conventional superhero films we've been seeing from Marvel. While at the same time, there were certainly the elements that were familiar in terms of the villains and the sort of chase aspect of the movie, offering that possibility of the next generation, but certainly for a movie franchise we've kind of gotten used to them having these ongoing stories that are feeding into each other to be showing something that really felt like an ending of some sort, and was very, very affecting at the end. I was getting quite choked up and teary at Wolverine passing away, and yes, it's comics, there's always the possibility of somebody coming back, but this felt pretty darn definitive. And that lovely little touch at the end of turning the cross into the X to emphasize the point was a very interesting way to sort of wind up this story.
Yeah, the second time around for me, going in there and knowing what was going to happen plot-wise and being able to pay more attention to some of the underlying themes and performances, and the second time around, the relationship between Logan and Charles is even more devastating, mm-hmm, I think, because, it's easy enough to say the first time that you go through, and yeah, this is much less of a superhero film than it is a film about, family and certain aspects of it. I think Gary in particular, I think maybe you brought it up where you felt like the moment at the very end between Logan and Laura was a little bit unearned. And I think the second time around, I definitely felt the same way, that it deepened the second time around. It was so much deeper for me, the relationship between Logan and Charles, that it made it even more obvious that they did not sell nearly enough the connection between Logan and Laura. For her to say, it still hits. I mean, my goodness, when she says daddy at the end. We didn't do a spoiler warning, but hey, guys, we're talking about a movie that's been out for a while. When she says that at the end, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference if they sold it well or not. It still just clawed to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's a slightly forced moment. Compared to, you feel the weight of the history of these characters that were there 20 years ago. And this movie is so much about the end of their journey that it just can't compare, in my opinion. And I think that you mentioned some of that before, Gary, as well. When you
It was the whole parent vibe was really forced for a guy who's barely known her for 36 hours or a week at best, and it was just that was a good way to compare it. When you see the depth of the relationship between Logan and Charles, and then you look at the relationship between Logan and his biological daughter, there's just a lack of depth to it. And I'm not saying didn't have its touching moments, but it just didn't really resonate very well with me for that aspect.
Yeah. Even to the point where the first time through, I feel like the Shane callback made sense. The second time it felt a lot less, I wouldn't say that it was like completely, non-existent connection, but then it felt like the seam is showing a little bit here. You're pushing the beat rather than letting it happen organically. But that said, I'm talking about like a minor change of a slight change of opinion. I still think that the film is one of the best things that come out of the X-Men franchise in years, not counting Deadpool, of course, which is a completely other end of the spectrum. But
yeah, definitely different flavors. Yes.
Yeah,
yes, indeed.
But certainly I think it's almost like your polar opposites of not serious in the slightest to ultra serious, but it's kind of trying to, if anything, I think you said, Edmund, that it's certainly more than what we've seen out of the main line of the X-Men films. And yeah, I think that's exactly what those two films do. They show you the breadth that they have to play with here and the opportunities and the possibilities. And now when you go and see a movie like Apocalypse, which is at least a middle range offering in that franchise, if not better in my opinion, it still feels like, wow, compare Deadpool, Logan, and X-Men Apocalypse. Yeah, I think I see why some people think Apocalypse just doesn't measure up at all.
Mm-hmm.
when you put it up against us.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but as I said when we initially reviewed it, this was not Logan was not a superhero film at all. It really wasn't. Yeah, you had claws and stuff like that, but it was really a character piece. It was not a, lightning bolts fly down and laser beams shoot out of eyes to accomplish your mission. It didn't take really even one claw to make this movie happen.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. The core of the film is not dependent upon the superhero side of it. It's more flavoring. Not unlike some of the movies that you see that are the more prestige science fiction films that use the setting more as just a garnish to the actual character drama underneath of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That brings us to our next topic here. And Edmund, I really am curious about your thoughts here.
Yes.
Ghost in the Shell.
I quite enjoyed it. And certainly one thing I found probably most surprising was even though I've over the years talked about avoiding previews and trailers and things, but certainly with all the controversy going on about casting Scarlett Johansson and was it whitewashing, I know we'd gotten into a little bit when I was still around, and certainly in terms of, some of that seemed to come from, be coming from people who didn't necessarily understand the original subject matter too well. But certainly one thing that I was feeling some trepidation about with the trailers was that they seemed to be putting this focus on, she has to, go back and find her humanity and her past life. And, and I was like, yeah, well, okay, Major Kusanagi, always seemed quite accepting of her, her cyber status, it seemed to be sort of grafting a more conventional motivations onto the character, and so I was quite pleasantly surprised to discover that that actually that aspect of the film, as far as I'm concerned, actually managed to highlight her heritage brought her Japanese passed to the fore, I think, far more than the original film and series ever did. So you know, this kind of this kind of irony of all these people, going up in arms about that aspect of it, and and it actually becomes pretty a pretty integral part, and the whole interaction, some rather touching scenes with her mother, and finally, even though they are, she's referring to herself as the major throughout, you do finally see Motoko Kusanagi on the grave at the end. I was very pleasantly surprised at the way that aspect did wind up being handled. I did have some reservations about it. The actual villain of the piece, did feel a little stock, and certainly the fact that they sort of went for a more conventional villain rather than some of the more intriguing psychological games that took place in the certainly in the original TV, various TV seasons and series, but I certainly understood why they would choose to go that way, and also certainly when the spider tank appeared, I was really really hoping that the major was going to manage to disable it in a less conventional way of actually maybe hacking into it and discovering that there was a bit of a machine intelligence there, and actually starting to introduce some of the unique relationships she has with those machines, back in the original series. So I thought that was an opportunity lost in the way that final battle was played out. But yeah, certainly, not the disaster that I think some people were hoping for, and I'm interested to see whether they actually do try and continue it beyond this.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think they will. First of all, it's made not nearly enough money to justify doing a follow up unless they severely curtailed the budget,
mm-hmm.
and I think that would hurt. I will say that, so let's, we can get into a little bit of the plot, but
yeah.
The aesthetic of it, I don't know about you,
mm-hmm.
but watched the original anime film a week before this came out, mm-hmm. and then saw this the weekend it came out.
Yeah.
And there were times my jaw was hitting the floor because it was like, holy cow, you managed to pull it off.
Yes.
Aesthetically, it looks dead on. Which, yeah, that is the money. A lot of the money is right there on the screen. And what was more impressive to me, and I think it's overlooked by a few people, is that the whole tone of the film, the feel of it, is not Hollywood blockbuster. It's, I wouldn't say art film or anything like that, but the aesthetic of the film is just, it does trying to sell you that this is an action-packed blockbuster. It feels more intimate than that,
mm-hmm.
which is really tough to do, but they pulled it off. And that's something that I really appreciated about this film, is that you don't feel like you are being, it's definitely way far away from your like superhero blockbuster type of film or anything like that. This is more thought provoking. Now, they did very obviously kind of put in some moments where people were practically like screaming at the people in the audience, here's the point. Here's what we're trying to say. Did you get it that time? And it was like, okay, yeah, anyone who was a film of the original who's here in the audience got it like 5 minutes in. We're good. Just keep going. But there were some moments of exposition where I was like, ooh, yeah, that's for the newcomers. Which, quite frankly, I don't think there were that many in the audience, but there we are.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that Garjo as the major was shockingly good, because I expected that to pretty much be one of the hardest sells that you would have. And I was like, wow, they actually visually made her look pretty dead on. And her performance is pretty solid. there were only a couple times where I felt like it was like, you know, maybe you know what I'm talking about, but there were only a couple times where I felt like it's like, okay, for such a recognizable actress, for her to only occasionally make me think, oh yeah, that's a ScarJo moment or line delivery or something like that. It just felt like, no, she committed to the role, in my opinion. I think everybody did.
Yeah, definitely.
Like I said, the weakest part was the villain, which I think was almost in and of itself intentional. So, but anyway, go ahead. You were going to say.
Yeah, no. So, I had not gone back and rewatched the original, but even so, I mean, certainly, the iconic shot on top of the building, and then, falling down into the, you know, into the action, was classic. But also, I mean, in terms of when you're talking about, so, you know, there's more intimate moments, the scenes with Batu on the boat, I mean, was certainly, mm-hmm. Straight out of, numerous scenes, from the movie and from the subsequent series. I'll absolutely agree that her performance, and certainly, it wasn't just the visuals, but the way she managed to capture that that cyborg melding of human and machine that is so central to the character and to the intent of the series and its commentaries. They were making sure people got those messages, but it's an interesting point that even though it has certainly these sort of Matrix like moments in some of the battles, search for identity and the meaning of identity with these sorts of creations was brought to the fore much more than I might have expected.
Right. Yeah, and that's where I think that maybe the tone, like I said, and then also the aesthetic that on top of it was so surprising, is that I really kept waiting for that moment when they were going to just full out go blockbuster on us, and it never really happened. You might say that the spider tank part at the end, but then that was right in the original film,
mm-hmm.
in a slightly different form. I mean, you described some of the differences, but I don't think that a straight up, and there are some people who say, oh, well, it should have been a straight up adaptation of the original film. I disagree. that was a film for the medium of the time.
Yes.
And if you tried to do a straight up adaptation of that, that would have flopped even more than this did. It just would never have translated well. And then, of course, there's the whole controversy that kind of got in the way of the film, which I think is very unfortunate. You yourself said it. There were people that seemed to want this movie to fail and didn't maybe understand the larger context of why that was a bad idea. You don't want high budget, high concept genre films to fail people. It's a really bad idea. If you want more of them, don't let them flop.
Yeah.
Or at least don't celebrate when they do, which is the other part of it, because this is slightly unrelated, but I know that, Gary, we talked about this before, but this was mentioned on Orange Lounge Radio a couple weeks ago regarding Mass Effect Andromeda, where, it's not a perfect game. It's got some it's got a number of bugs and glitches. It feels a little bit unfinished, but all of the social media discussion about it is about how horrible it is because of those flaws. So what is the message that the people behind it that put money behind that game, what message are they getting? Is it a balanced message? Is it celebrating the positives as well as, taking a critical look at the negatives? No, it's nothing but negative, negative, negative. And I feel like that's the message that people, if that's the message that you're putting out there, is that here are all the reasons that you should never, ever do a movie like this again, then don't come back in 5 years and say, why won't anybody make the adaptation of this? Well, gee, I think I would know why. Because you ripped people to shreds. You basically went on a Twitter war because you disagreed with the casting for a movie or something like that. Sight unseen at the time. I can understand something where it is blatantly cast wrong, shall we say. But when we take everything and raise it to this level of outrage over it doesn't meet my particular way that I want it to be done, and then we get surprised when nobody wants to fund or back these projects. What's, you know, what do they get out of it? They get just a pile of vitriol. It's amazing to me that it's so short-sighted. At the very least, I could have understood that people are like, you know what? I don't agree with the casting, or I don't like the casting, or I don't think they're going to do a good job of it. I'm just going to not even bother with it at all and move on with my life. But to just have to sit and take the time and energy to be so negative and then wonder why that's the perception of the entire audience. That, you know, cater to me. But when you do, I'm going to do nothing but tell you the 10,000 ways that you didn't cater to me the way I wanted you to. Self-defeating. But at any rate, yeah, I mean, that's very much on the list of things that kind of frustrate me with this movie, because at the end of the day, does it have some flaws? Sure. But like you said, Edmund, it's a really good representation of the concepts. And visually, this is, you won't find a better adaptation of an anime out there right now, live action. You just won't.
Yeah.
And yeah, shoot yourself in the foot, people. Do it again. Why not? Any other thoughts here on this film?
Yeah, no, I will. I will sort of just to agree that it is unfortunate that you know, something that in the end turned out so well. Yeah, just it was not really given a chance to fly as I might have wished.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate timing for this to happen too, because of all the other projects that were kind of in the pipeline that I have a feeling are going to get short shrift now. At the very least, they'll wind up with their budget slashed, which is not going to help at all in any way. Any other films that you've seen recently that maybe we've been able to partake in?
Actually, no. That's been the main ones I've caught. Although I actually on a, you know, speaking of anime, over the past couple of years or so, I've been slowly introducing my mother, now that I'm back in her neck of the woods, to the Studio Ghibli output. But kind of in interesting way around, because it actually started with her seeing the Tale of Princess Kaguya, the final Takahata film, and then only yesterday when they were being shown on the big screen here in New York. And so she's sort of going starting from the Takahata end of things, then been slowly introducing her to some of the earlier Miyazakis, we worked our way up to finally seeing Spirited Away the other night. And as we've been talking earlier this week about revisiting books and things, it's also kind of fun doing that with with these movies that I when I first discovered Ghibli, sort of, you know, devoured them all in a great big rush, and it's kind of nice to go back and watch them and get a chance to savor them a little bit more this time.
That's always a good thing to do for these films. Let's see, as we are wrapping up kind of this particular episode shortly, I also want to just kind of throw it out there. Mentioned this briefly, I think, to everyone, but we're now 4 episodes into the new season of Attack on Titan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you up to speed?
I haven't seen the 4th one yet, but I have seen the first 3. It's great to have that back. And some of these new twists they've introduced are quite intriguing, if not a bit terrifying. I mean, certainly the whole idea of this sentient furry titan is a development that really can't end well, you would think, for a bunch of our favorite characters.
That would be an understatement.
Yes.
What I find really interesting here is that they are really following the manga very closely.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what is kind of fun is having read this particular stretch a long time ago, is kind of revisiting this material and thinking, now that I know a lot more about what's going on, is going, wow, they did a really nice job of seeding things into the story that I kind of forgot that they did. And man, was it a lot more messed up than I remembered. So it's unfortunate that this is only a 12-episode season.
Mm-hmm.
That really annoyed me because of all the talk that came beforehand, made it seem like they were waiting because they needed the material for another long, 25-episode, roughly, season. And then for them to basically say, nope, it's going to be half that.
Mm.
It's like, boy, all your excuses for taking so long no longer really work. Yes, but anyway, it happens. It happens. The industry over there for anime is fraught with various pitfalls and difficulties. So just the fact that they finally got out a new season, I think that basically the story arc that they're telling is a really strong one, and it's probably good that they focus their efforts on a strong story rather than trying to cram a whole bunch of stuff in. But yeah, they're following it pretty closely, and it's a really good adaptation. And one of the things I really like is that they basically just pick up where they left off, so that if you were to just keep watching the episodes, it looks almost seamless.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty good good trick to pull off, because it has been a pretty good length of time. I'm sure that there are people kind of upset that there's less representation from certain characters, but guys, they're following the story. That's the way it worked. But yeah, definitely good to have that back, even for just a short period of time.
Yes. Yeah, although I had not realized it was only 12 episodes, so now I'm annoyed about that as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I found that out earlier today. Apparently I'd missed that memo.
Mm.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So, yeah, it's required weekend viewing here, so.
Of course.
Literally. Okay, they aired in Japan. When do I get it? All right, well, we're going to go ahead and wrap this particular episode up, and then when we come back next time, we're going to get into episodic discussion for this week. So, until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.